standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio has a lot of history. In the old days, you didn't have a vector network analyzer. You didn't have directional couplers. You didn't have impedance measuring antenna analyzer. You didn't have all this stuff. All you had is, in the case of a coaxial cable, a slatted line. In the case of open wire transmission line, you had something called letcher wire. So in either case of letcher wire or slotted line, you've got some kind of a detector that you're able to slide along the length of the transmission line. And that detector, which in some cases was nothing more than a neon bulb, in some cases it was a detecting diode going into a meter, but that probe on your slotted line, or that probe-like device on your open wire line, as you slide it along, you would see at some particular point along the line a peak of voltage or a peak of brilliance of your neon bulb, and you slide it another quarter of a wavelength forward or reverse, and you'll see a valley of brilliance or a valley of voltage. Now, that voltage maximum, voltage minimum ratio, that is voltage standing wave ratio. In the old days of a slotted line, or in the old days of a letcher wire system, you really measured peak voltage, valley voltage. Therefore, you measured the voltage ratio. We called it standing wave ratio. We really measured it in those days. Let me drop. And the reason you saw a peak and a valley is because in every general transmission line, some amount of power is going forward and some smaller amount of power is reflected back because the load is less than perfect. The forward going power and the reverse going power somewhere along that line are in phase with each other. Somewhere else along that line, a quarter wavelength away, they're out of phase with each other. Where they're out of phase with each other, you see less indication. Where they're in phase with each other, you see a greater indication. That ratio we called standing wave ratio. But we don't measure directly standing wave ratio anymore. With all of our current instrumentation, we measure forward energy, reverse energy ratio. We can measure it in voltage, we can measure it in power, we can measure it in decibels, you can measure it in all kinds of units, but after you make a measurement that you understand what units you're using, and you use the right calculation, you can now reinterpret it into standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio is the archaic measurement that we used to make. Let me drop. Unfortunately, it's the most popular ways of describing things. For traditional reasons, we keep calling it standing wave ratio. But nowadays, that's the coded message. We don't measure it anymore. Our modern day instrumentation measures power forward and reverse ratio, or voltage forward and reverse ratio, either as a scalar voltage, just pure magnitude in other words, or in the case of a VNA, you measure the real vector of voltage. In other words, you're measuring the magnitude and its phase angle. And that phase angle measurement of a VNA, vector network analyzer, allows you to calculate with proper calibration exactly what is the nature of that antenna's load. Even though it might be 150 feet away from you with a properly calibrated system sitting in the shack with a VNA, in theory, you can make the measurement of what that antenna is doing today as if you had all of your instrumentation right at the input connector of the antenna, even though it's 150 feet away on the other end of the transmission line. In theory, you can make that measurement in a calibrated manner, and you find out today that your 50-ohm antenna just turned into 75 ohms of resistance and 100 ohms of reactance, if you know what I mean, and whether it's capacitive or inductive, you'll know that. So with modern-day instrumentation, we measure reflected voltage ratio and reflected power ratio. Drop. Let me drop. That's the real measurement we make today. And if you know what you're talking about, that's the useful information. You want the reflected voltage or reflected power to go to zero when you're tuning that device, amplifier, antenna, or whatever it is. You want to tune it for a minimum reflected power, minimum reflected voltage. And one has a direct relationship to the other. And so we measure reflection coefficient today. That's the real measurement. And to now reinterpret that measurement back into the traditional standing wave ratio, we're coding the message, so to speak, in order to satisfy a tradition. If this is the best of all worlds, we would essentially abandon voltage standing wave ratio. We'd abandon those words, SWR, VSWR, because we don't really use that today. And let me think about that. Just by the same token, in the old days, we did not have a frequency counter. In 1920, with your Letcher wire system, with your slotted line, you could measure the distance between the peaks and the valleys, where you could measure the distance between two consecutive peaks, and now you are measuring directly wavelength, measured wavelength in 1920. Therefore, we called it the 20-meter band. We called it the 40-meter band, the 80-meter band. We measured wavelength. We couldn't count the frequency. Let me drop. Nowadays, by way of our frequency counter, nowadays by way of a phase lock loop system, we know we're on 3.7500 megahertz, and we can count it. In those days, you couldn't. You could measure wavelength, and in the case of optical systems today, the middle of the optical band that your eye is operating at, we call it 550 nanometers. We can measure wavelength. We haven't got a frequency counter that works at 10 to the 15 hertz. That's what your optical frequency is, they say. You take that exact same radio wave, and you and I have got a gut feel of what 600 megacycles means. So a 600 megacycle radio wave, if I multiply that 1 million times, 600 megahertz, that's the middle of the optical wavelength that your eye operates. That's 550 nanometers. So because we haven't got counters that go that high at optical frequency, there we still measure wavelengths. But we're getting a more exact measurement without all of this volumetric instrumentation. A slotted line at 80 meters is a very unusual thing. It would be very big. But a simple frequency counter, I mean, that's smaller than a cell phone these days, a frequency counter that will count the frequencies at the 80-meter band, for instance. So counting frequency today is a much more amenable technique. We don't measure wavelength there anymore. We calculate wavelength. We call it the 80-meter band. Anybody got any further questions or comments on what you've heard so far? Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet. W2SAW. W2SAW. Sierra Alpha Whiskey. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. You got it.
Good evening, Dick. The name is Bill. This might be a little bit of a crazy question, but if the resistance of free space is 377 ohms and your antenna is 50 ohms, how come we don't have a standing wave reflection in this situation between the interface of the antenna and free space?
Yeah, when we talk about the impedance of free space, Bill, the ratio of voltage and current, voltage and magnetic field, that radio wave propagating free space, with the right kind of instrumentation, you can measure how many volts per meter is coming out of that wave, out of that antenna. You measure it to 10 feet away, for instance. You measure volts per meter. That's E field. You measure magnetic field, sometimes called H. You measure that in amps per meter. The ratio between the volts per meter and the amps per meter, the ratio between the magnetic field and the electric field, calculates to be 377, 120 pi. That's what free space is. You and I do not feed free space directly. When you feed the center of a dipole is a standing wave structure. Let me drop. That signal coming down your transmission line, and after it goes through the balance, hits the dipole, you would like to believe that signal flows down the wire of your dipole and jumps into space. Absolutely not. Doesn't do that. Now, the first pass of that signal down all of that wire of your 80-meter dipole is flowing down that 132-foot total length, 67 feet each side. The signal flows down that wire. About 5% of it gets radiated. 95% is left over. It's the egg insulator at the end of your dipole and reflects back. Another 5% almost is radiated on the second pass on the way back and comes back to the beginning. So 90% of the power you sent down that wire on the previous cycle, 90% of it comes back out of phase with the signal now coming out of your transmitter. It took a quarter wavelength to go down, a quarter wavelength to come back. It's delayed half a wave. It's now the positive voltage that came out of your transmitter in the previous cycle is now a negative reflective voltage coming back from the tips of your antenna. And so it meets an almost short circuit at the center. Therefore, the center of your dipole, you see what you think is 72 ohms. You're seeing a signal bouncing back and forth 10 times, and you're seeing the reactive result of an almost cancellation. So you see 72 ohms. That's not the impedance of the antenna. If that signal went down the wire once and got radiated into space, the impedance you would see on the antenna would be something closer to 1,500 ohms, 1,000 or 2,000 ohms. It would be a very high impedance. And where did that impedance come from? Well, your piece of wire, let me drop it. Your piece of wire is some number of wavelengths above ground. The ground is another conductive plate, so to speak, as far as that radio is concerned. You think your ground has got glass on it, So that radio wave at 80 meters, that ground is nearly a perfect mirror. So you've got a piece of wire above a sheet of metal, so to speak, and the diameter of the wire and the spacing means that it's approximately a 1,500 ohm impedance strip line transmission line. I'm rounding up the numbers a little bit. So as a transmission line, your wire is a 1,500 ohm impedance thing. So if the signal went down there once and radiated in space, you'd see 1,500 ohms. So the 75 ohms and 72 ohms that you see in your dipole is not the impedance of free space. It's the ratio of the power that got radiated on each pass. So impedance of free space is not something you can easily wrap your hands around, if you know what I mean. By these laboratory measurements of E field and H field, you can calculate it. And when it comes to that signal traveling through free space, let me drop this. The signal traveling through free space hits your chunk of wood, which is a very different medium, and maybe your chunk of wood has got an impedance of 105 ohms instead of 377. So a certain amount of the power is going to reflect off the forward surface of your wood. The wood can be dry as all hell. You and I think it's a perfect insulator. You put your ohmmeter across, you're going to measure a zillion megohms. So you think it's an open circuit, not to a radio wave. That's a brand new medium with a brand new impedance that's lower. Almost everything you do that you add to free space lowers the impedance in that vicinity. So it gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on here, but I know I've created some more questions. W2SAW. That's a nice set of call letters, K2RAW. You got it, Bill.
Thanks a lot, Dick. That helps me visualize it. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I have one. I have some oldies. It's 4191A Hewlett Packard. And this is the RF impedance analyzer. So it's something that is pretty simple in operation, and it comes from 80s. Now, what puzzles me is that this thing, even though that I can measure all of the parameters of the impedance, for the practical measurement is giving me the impedance range and the resistance range spans from 100 milliohms to 20 kilohms. So my question is, why Hewlett-Packard design that equipment that goes up to that range? I mean, it goes to 100 kilo-ohm at max, but 20 kilo-ohm is practical one. And to
In the beginning, people thought about the impedance of a device you hang on the end of a transmission line as to the resistive component and the capacitive component. You rapidly get that idea by looking at the Brown and Woodward curves. Go to chapter 4 of almost any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and one of the first set of curves you'll see is this, the curves that were done in 1945 by Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward. They spent about a man year of their life measuring every possible monopole. They choose all the possible diameters, all the possible lengths, all the possible frequencies, and they, by the the instrumentation they had in those days, they did a mountain of work of resetting the signal generator, using a frequency meter to measure the frequency of the meter, using a slotted line with careful measurements and slide rule, calculating what was the impedance of all of these monopoles at all of these frequencies, where the monopoles were different diameters and different lengths, a mountain of data. And they boiled it all down to one chart, which is called the resistive component, and one chart that's called the capacitive component. So you choose your particular chosen diameter of your monopole, your chosen length of your monopole, your chosen frequency, and you go to that chart. They'll tell you within a few percent accuracy of error, they'll tell you exactly what resistive component that monopole antenna is going to present to you and what reactive component that antenna is going to present to you. So the resistive chart has got a whole bunch of lines for different diameters and lengths of wire. The reactive chart's got a whole bunch of lines for resistive for length and diameter of wire of the monopole. And so, about
repeater, timeout.
As I said, that data took them about a man year to assemble, but it's real measured data. And so a couple of people came along afterwards and tried to do a curve matching program, curve matching equation synthesis, where now you want to take your length and the diameter and frequency information and enter it into an equation that predicts impedance. It's a curve matching equation, which is an approximation. And a ridiculous number of very smart people today go to that equation. They assume that it is a real derivation of impedance versus frequency. And they use the equation as if it's the gospel truth. And it's not. It's a curve matching equation for a certain section of the chart, a popular section of the chart, the Brown and Woodward curves. And if you start going to larger diameter, less popularly used monopoles, the equation falls down because the equation didn't do impedance match, didn't do curve matching in that area. So the real information on those curves is from the horse's mouth. The equation is, by my standards, garbage. I don't use it. And that partially explains why fat antennas are so unpopular, because people don't know there's a huge benefit from doing that. So in the beginning, measuring resistive component, measuring reactive component, that's what Brown and Woodward did. So for Hewlett-Packard to come up with instrumentation to do that was very logical in that time. In, let me pick a number, 1970, if somebody told you, let me drop it. If somebody told you in 1970 that I'm going to take a high-frequency wave, and let me pick a number, 50 megahertz, in 1970 that was considered a very high frequency, to measure the amplitude of a 50-megacycle signal on a power meter, on a bird watt meter, very easy. And if somebody told you, I'm not going to measure the frequency, I'm going to measure the phase, they consider 50 megacycles a signal that was so fast, so many zillions of cycles per second, 50 million cycles per second, and I'm going to measure the phase angle of every one of those cycles. You say those words in 1970, and people said, nah, you can dream about that, we're not going to do it. Along come Hewlett-Packard with sampling detectors, and I'm talking about a set of diodes that you turn on for a sub-nanosecond. You turn it on for approximately a picosecond. In other words, you can, by the sampling detector, make a measurement at every single angle from 0 to 360 degrees of that particular 50 megacycle wave. I can decide to measure the amplitude 1 degree downrange, 41 degrees downrange, 361 degrees downrange. I can decide to measure the specific amplitude of that 50 megahertz sine wave by that sampling detector, because it operates so fast, makes such a brief measurement, that even though the 50 megacycle signal is moving very fast, I can make a measurement so fast that to me it's standing still, as if I'm using a stroboscope. That was a beautiful invention in roughly 1970, real high-quality sampling detectors. And after that came sampling oscilloscopes of time domain reflectometry. Oh, boy. So once you've got that sampling detector in your bag of tricks, now you can measure vectors of voltage. In other words, you measure specific amplitude and specific phase angle. Now all of a sudden this great mathematics called scattering parameters starts making a lot of
repeater timeout.
So once scattering parameters were suddenly boiled down to a vector network analyzer, you no longer see Hewlett-Packard producing many more RX meters per se. The vector network analyzer does everything properly used. So in the old days, when you had something under measurement, whether it be step attenuator, whether it be an amplifier, whether it be an antenna, the first thing you did is you went and got a signal generator. Then you went and got a frequency meter that you connected after the signal generator to measure its accuracy. You got all the cables and adapters that fed signals into your device under test. Then you went and got detecting devices, which might be a power meter, a sampling, an oscilloscope, a fast oscilloscope. See, you assembled all of this bench full of equipment every time you wanted to make a measurement. And so around 1970, people started saying, hey, we keep doing the same operation over and over again, getting a signal generator, getting a way of measuring the frequency coming out of the signal generator, getting a way of measuring the power and voltage coming out of the signal generator, getting a detector, and making sure the detector has got the right sensitivity, the right step attenuators in front of it, and the right amplitude accuracy. We keep assembling this bench full of equipment day in and day out. Every time we want to make a measurement, why don't we put all of that in one box? And that was the beginning of the one-box measurement signal source, signal detection system, which once you add vector, once you add sampling detectors in there where you can measure phase, it suddenly became a vector network analyzer. Those were later words. In the very beginning, it was just a combined piece of test equipment in one box, which was source and detecting and amplitude calibration, if you know what I mean. So once you've got a vector network analyzer and you understand how to use it, and if it's got the right kind of a
repeater timeout.
Boy, I'm getting real good at timing out tonight. It's getting and it's real good at the calibration by way of the so-called 12-point calibration procedure, which I think is another Hewlett-Packard invention. By way of the microprocessor with a good program in there that makes it very user-friendly. As you start getting to the later and later vector network analyzers, from roughly the year 2000 and on, all of a sudden it becomes very user-friendly. I had a real intense hate of vector network analyzers of the 1970-75 time frame because it was so darn bulky, all kinds of external jazz, to go through the calibration procedure and to go through the measurement and interpretation of the measurement. It was a dog of a problem. And all of a sudden you got things like Hewlett-Packard, Agilent, and Rodin-Schwarz, 2000 and later vector network analyzer, where an awful lot of the dog work, the hard work the human being used to have done, has all been automated. And now you can sweep across ridiculously wide frequency regions, 30 sweeps per second, make simultaneous four separate measurements of those S parameters, S11, S21, S12, and S22, make all those measurements 30 times per second for all of those measurements, display it on the screen so fast that there is no flicker on the screen, and now everything looks to you like real time. You're moving your hand around a device on the desk, which might be an antenna. Let me drop it. You're watching all of those curves in four different colors go up and down on that XY plot or on that Smith chart, whichever you like. And now you're seeing in real time all of the parameter changes as you make your adjustments to that antenna. And as such, you can find antenna solutions that you never knew existed because by serendipity, you wave your hand across the two elements of an antenna somewhere near the director and driven element, and you watch the gain go up and the VSWR get better, and you say, wow, whatever I just did, I got to do more of that. You sweep your hand by it, you watch the curve move in real time as you did that, and you say, wow, is that good? In the old days, it would take a man day of measurements to get that curve on your on that screen that was there for you in a 30th of a second. Let me run that by again. A modern-day vector network analyzer in a 30th of a second will display all of that data you want on that screen. That in the old days of a Smith chart, the old days of a slotted line, signal generator, and frequency measuring device and detector, it would take you a day's worth of labor to get the data that's on that screen in a 30th of a second.
Don't you think that the practicality comes from the point that in real life, in practice, we really really have a need to analyze in RF circuitry the impedances more than 20 kilohertz. The basic 50 ohm, then we could go down to zero, so it's from zero to 20 kilohertz. Is that true or false?
You gotta be careful now. You got in front of you a piece of 50 ohm cable, RG8, RG213, RG214, a 50 ohm piece of cable. At most of the RF frequencies, like roughly 1 megahertz to 1,000 megahertz, you do some careful measurement, that is a 50 ohm cable. You go below 1 megahertz approximately, where the skin depth of penetration of the center conductor and the braid starts coming close to the thickness of the braid. Your 50 ohm cable down at, let me pick a number, 10 kilohertz, is not a 50 ohm cable.
Beautiful answer. Actually, you're completely right. That one, the 4191A, is from 1 megahertz up to 1,000 megahertz. So that's why probably they mentioned 20 kilohertz as a maximum practicality.
So as I was starting to say, one of the best kept secrets is a 50 ohm cable is not a 50 ohm cable down at extremely low frequencies. It's a hell of a lot more reactive, not a pure resistance anymore. It's impedance. On top of that, you and I would like to believe that a 50 ohm cable with single shield, or in the case of RG9 or RG214, where you've got a double braided shield, inner braid is silver plated, outer braid is copper plated, you'd like to believe that it's extremely well shielded. Not at all. You pass that RG214 double braided coaxial cable near the magnetic field coming out of a 60 cycle transformer, and you'll be amazed how much signal walks through that outer shield of the transformer, walks into that center conductor, and will give you hum on your circuit. So when it comes to shielding magnetic field at lower frequencies, what you and I have come to believe is an extremely good shield, a double braid on a well-constructed piece of cable, where each one of those braids is 98% covering. Let me drop it. That's not a good shield anymore. You have to use other techniques like mu metal and humbucking techniques and so on to get rid of the local magnetic field that your wiring picks up in the case of a poorly designed transformer that has a lot of radiating external 60 cycle magnetic field. And there's a lot of transformers out there that do that. And I ran into that problem with the AIL 707 spectrum analyzer, the company in New Jersey that was manufacturing those power transformers for us. In one particular 6-month period of time, he went to the low bidder to buy the steel to make the EI laminations inside the transformer, and the particular steel he bought was lower in permeability than the previous steel. Therefore, the same number of turns of primary and secondary windings on that transformer made the transformer go much closer to saturation. So the amount of 60 cycle magnetic field radiated from the transformer suddenly increased pretty bad. It was coupling into all of our circuits and giving us hum into the voltage-controlled oscillators, into the oscilloscope display, and so on. And when that exact same transformer, which was rated for 50 hertz performance when it's used in Japan, all of a sudden the transformer was saturating so bad it made loud humming noises at 50 hertz in Japan, and we started getting complaints from those particular customers that it wasn't working very well. That transformer was radiating lots of magnetic fields, so we had to solve the problem at the source, the transformer. But to shield magnetic fields from 50 or 60 hertz, that's an art and science in itself, and your cable is no longer 50 ohms down there anymore, which is a real slap in the face, if you know what I mean, if you didn't expect it. KQLIW listening, have any further questions or comments on all of the above?
It's a good reminder to keep your leads short when you're making sensitive measurements with a directional coupler as well.
Now, who was that masked man?
N1KBY.
diagram and understanding of circuit theory, but it quite often requires a good physical layout. The last thing you should do is to have a input RF coaxial connector that doesn't have a well-grounded local connector interface into your printed circuit board, for instance. So there's quite a bit of smarts required in launching signals from a connector onto a printed circuit board. When it comes to so-called common mode grounding, good operational amplifier techniques, and so on, to make all your circuit work well requires the right kind of layout. You're not going to take the high power RF output end and put it near the low level of video input end of your printed circuit board. You're going to get cross coupling between the two. So layout is important, both from the point of view of assembling the parts, and not getting a difficulty of assembly, not getting cross coupling of the various signals, making sure your switching power supply and all of its transients is not coupled into your low-level circuitry. Nowadays, very few circuits contain a 60-cycle power transformer anymore. They're too big, bulky, they weigh too much, and with modern techniques of switching power supplies, you can get all of that in a small fraction of the cost, weight, and volume. And some of the early and cheaply made switching power supplies can make an awful lot of occult generator characteristic signals all over the spectrum. But there are ways of making switching power supplies that are very well behaved. That switching power supply that was in the December 1999, 2002, the January issue 2000 of QST Magazine by the man, Manfred Bornhenweg is his name, from La Salina, Chile. Who in the world would think that such a very high-performance switching power supply? I'm talking about 12 volts output, 40 amperes. Let me drop it. The switching power supply. Mike, why am I having trouble thinking of his call letters again, John? If you can think of his call letters, tell me. He's got an extra-class license equivalent in Chile, and he worked for the European Southern Observatory. He made this extremely well-designed power supply with homebrew equipment. He had to homebrew his own inductors for the switching power supply because they weren't available to him. And he couldn't get down to Santiago, Chile, which didn't have a Radio Shack store, if you know what I mean. For him to even get coaxial cable imported to his country was difficult. So he made this elaborate-looking switching power supply that appeared in QSD Magazine. And you study that design. At first you'd say, gee, it's got too many components. Let me jump. That power supply has got a lot of history. He was maintaining the repeaters on tops of mountains in Chile. And for him to get to those mountaintops to fix a defective or a failed power supply was a pain in the tail. So he made sure the power supply had very high reliability because he didn't want to keep coming back, particularly not in the wintertime. So this power supply, when you look at it, looks like it's got too many components. When you study it and you know what you're looking at, every one of those components is there for a reason. It's a self-protecting power supply. You can put a direct short circuit. You can put in a load on it that's too inductive, too capacitive, and whatever, and the power supply will self-protect. And when it comes to testing, I think the power supply ran at roughly 100 kc switching rate. And you can wrap a wire around that power supply, wrap it, bring that wire into the input connector of your 80 through 10 meter receiver, scan continuously across the band, looking for spurious signals coming out of the power supply, and you will not find them. That is a design. So, if you're willing to spend the time, a switching power supply can be quiet as all hell, efficient as all hell, reliable as all hell, self-protecting, inexpensive, high-end performance. Other than that, it's good. So, just because somebody has come out in the early days of cheaply made, poorly designed switching power supplies that created a lot of grief, let me drop it. Don't jump to the conclusion that switching power supplies are bad. Just like in the beginning, I came to the conclusion that vector network analyzers were too troublesome to use, too much rigmarole, took too much time, and all of a sudden, the modern-day vector network analyzers with a good microprocessor and a good program for calibrating built in, and fancy displays that acted fast, all of a sudden they came along, and I went from hating that machine to loving that machine. And I used it every single day, a good number of hours per day for 10 solid years, while designing a bunch of antennas. that resulted in a significant number of antenna patent applications. So, by the way, when it comes to antennas, you take the average electrical engineering student coming out of a good school where he decided to specialize in wireless engineering techniques, radio, and you ask him, how many kinds of antennas are there? And I've interviewed quite a few of these guys fresh out of school, and sometimes out of the school for 10 years. I've interviewed them because they were applying for a position at the particular company I was working at on the job. And you ask them, how many kinds of antennas are they? And you typically got answers between 30, 50, 70 kinds of antennas. Is their sincere belief after all of their experience and all of the courses they took on radio engineering. They thought there was that number of antennas. In my opinion, there's more than 5,000 kinds of antennas. And if you look at the patent section out of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, the monthly journal, you look at the patent section, you look at all the brand new antennas that have been invented each individual month, and you suddenly realize that 5,000 is a low number. Yeah, quite a few of those antennas are of a known generic type where a guy has made a significant modification to them. And so you take, for instance, a Yagi antenna designed by Mr. Hindusui Yagi, roughly 1928, and published in the IRE, Institute of Radio Engineers, American Journal at that time. So we've had the Yagi antenna in open literature since 1928, roughly. And along came a guy, K2RIW, who reinvented the Yagi antenna in roughly 2003, filed for that patent, and it was granted. Enough modifications of these very wide elements with different coupling coefficient structures and different impedance matching structures, and all of a sudden you end up with a Yagi-like antenna that's 10 times more broad than an ordinary antenna at that frequency range would be, 10 times more broad, 10 times lower in standing wave ratio, and high performance and gain, all made out of a simple piece of copper sheet metal onto a piece of insulating sheet of material. So even the word Yagi has multiple embodiments, if you know what I mean. So lots of antennas, and so you got to be careful in how you judge things that are good and bad. I started off in roughly the year 2001 saying that the vector network analyzers are bad. I'm not going to use them. I'm going to use some other technique. I was a spectrum analyzer man instead of a vector network analyzer man. And by the way, there's only a little bit of bias there. Let me drop it. Only a little bit of bias there because I was heavily involved in the design of the Hewlett-Packard, the Airborne Instruments Laboratory AIL-707 spectrum analyzer of the mid-1970s. I was heavily involved in the design of that, and for a number of years I was the engineering manager of spectrum analyzer products. So I was a spectrum analyzer lover and a vector network analyzer hater in those days. And now I've changed. One of the definitions of intelligence is the ability to adapt to a new environment. Maybe I should say the word readapt. So something that I used to hate, all of a sudden I now love when it's done correctly. Hey, with any further questions and comments on all of the above, give me your name and call. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
I have one more.
Go ahead, Wes.
And thanks, Jim. On 4194A, this one goes to 100 megahertz. And I just put on test one 10 kilo ohm resistor. It's 1%, so it's a pretty good one. And all of a sudden I see it's completely linear up to 1 megahertz, and then after that rapidly goes down at roughly 10 megahertz. I have only 3 kilo ohm impedance, and we're not talking about the resistor because the resistor is written on the resistor, and then it varies. So question is, what are the hints for the guys like you who were designing a spectrum analyzer to design a high-frequency circuitry?
Well, if it was an Allen Bradley carbon composition resistor with axial leads coming out of it, depending on how you mount it and you're using it at high frequencies, you can get some pretty crazy impedances. If you mounted it in the ideal structure so that the series inductance of the leads is not the dominant factor, and you get the right kind of a shell around it, almost in a coaxial structure, what you soon discover is that the end caps inside, if you could see an X-ray picture of that resistor, it's got end caps that are in contact with that carbon resistive cylindrical slug that's in the center. Those end caps eventually have a certain number of picofarad of capacitance between the end caps. When you get up to a high enough frequency, that the end cap capacitance of that few picofarads starts becoming a fairly low capacitive reactance. The slug of resistance in the middle starts becoming a significant length at that frequency, where it's an inductive length. So you got some series inductance of the copper of the carbon slug. You got parallel capacitance of the end caps, and you've got some series inductance of the leads coming out of it. In order to mount those leads in the printed circuit board, you bent them over, increasing their inductance. So a 50 ohm resistor, carbon composition resistor, properly mounted, it can probably use it to 100 megahertz. A 10 kilo ohm resistor, you're not going to get away with that anywhere near that high end frequency, because the same amount of capacitor reactance is going to be more dominant on 100 kilo ohms or 10 kilo ohms than it will on 50 ohms. So the way you make a high power dummy alone 50 ohm resistor, I want to make a resistor that can tolerate a kilowatt of input, and I want the resistor to be a pure 50 ohm load between DC and 1000 megahertz. And the Bird Company does make such a thing. But now you study the internal structure of that thing, and boy, it's very different than the carbon composition resistor you're talking about. It slowly tapers from one diameter to another diameter and slowly attenuates that signal that's slowing down that structure. So it is almost a kind of very highly dissipative, very short length transmission line with variable diameters in just the right spot. So there's a whole art and science to designing a 50 ohm dummy load that's going to be nearly a pure resistor at most of the frequencies of interest and still tolerate high power, and most of that power is turned into heat that goes out to the heat fins on the outside of the device. There's a lot of history that goes into that kind of a design. So just making a resistor behave at high frequencies, you've got to be careful. And how about an inductor? Let me drop. If I want to make a inductor that's used as a way of feeding feeding DC power into the center conductor of a coax cable, because I want that power to go up the center conductor of my coax cable and power my electronics that's sitting at the top of the tower. And that signal coming out of that electronics at the top of the tower is going to flow back down that same cable. That's a very efficient design when you do it correctly already. That RF choke that couples DC voltage and current into that center conductor, it's got to be very carefully designed if you want very broad bandwidth. There's a way of making a spiral wound inductor in air where the spiral is wound on a cone-shaped mandrel, so to speak. So it's a large diameter at the base, small diameter at the top coil. And when you do that correctly, you can have many octaves of bandwidth out of that inductor where it doesn't run into self-resonance. Ordinarily, you wind an ordinary solenoid. Let me drop. You take a solenoid winding of a inductor, and at some particular frequency, the capacitance between the turns and the capacitance between the ends of the inductor will make it go into resonance. So every inductor, within reason, has a self-resonant frequency. Every capacitor, by way of the reactance of the leads, has a self-resonant frequency. So if you go far enough in frequency, capacitors, no matter how carefully you construct them, are not very pure. Inductors are not very pure. Resistors are not very pure. And so there's a whole different way of thinking required when you want a whole lot of bandwidth out of an inductor, a resistor, or a capacitor, and you want it to cover a very wide frequency range. You've got to be careful with the way you physically design it, and no matter what and what materials you choose to make it out of. There's a whole art and science to doing that. You read the right books, and they'll give you some of the hints that people have developed over the years in order to make inexpensive circuits become very broadband in performance if you know what you're doing, particularly when it comes to operational amplifiers. Let me drop. In the early days of operational amplifiers, they really went beyond over 100 kilohertz. You can now buy operational amplifiers that go up to a gigahertz, and some of those operational amplifiers have got 120 decibels of gain inside. Oh boy, that's a disaster waiting to happen. You take that amount of gain and that amount of bandwidth, and by the way, they don't come to mind. You don't get 120 dB of gain and 1 gigahertz of bandwidth simultaneously. But what I'm getting at is you get a whole lot of gain in a very small package for a very inexpensive price. And if you don't have the right kind of bypassing capacitors and the right kind of lead lag networks and whatever in the feedback of that operational amplifier, you can easily convert that into a really broadband high power oscillator, if you know what I mean. So anything with high gain in a small package, you got to be careful about making sure that it doesn't break into oscillation. To make it unconditionally stable requires some pretty careful techniques.
One more. John has, I acquired by accident 8753D, which goes to 6 gigahertz network analyzer. John actually has two or three of them. Maybe John has one of the questions about the network analyzer, John?
KC2WGB. No, not really, Wes. Continue.
He already got more knowledge about it than I am just getting into it. I put a couple of calibration kits into the network analyzer, but then I find out that if you didn't turn us then you connect the, let's say, the direction coupler and has N connector on it. And now you need to have a set of N connectors and then SMA connectors or whatsoever. My question is, in your practice, what problems did you have experience with calibration of that?
When you're using a modern high-class, I call it high-class, vector network analyzer that goes from some number of kilohertz up to 8 gigahertz, for instance, and you want to make good measurements in the 1 gigahertz region, you need a calibration kit if you want to make quantitative measurements. Mori Microwave in California is a company that makes very good calibration kits. In fact, if you buy the calibration kit for your vector network analyzer from the Hewlett-Packard company in those days, you maybe were getting a Mori Microwave calibration kit that was relabeled with a Hewlett-Packard label on it, but it's really manufactured by Mori. And so Mori will make you a calibration kit. Let me drop. They'll make you a calibration kit with SMA connectors, type N connectors. I don't think they make one with UHF connectors. That's not a precision connector, but type N is considered precision. SMA is considered precision. And there's also higher quality versions of the SMA connector, the 2.5 millimeter, for instance. And there's APC7 and APC3 connectors. So they will build you calibration kits where they're sending you a short and open and a dummy load that easily goes to 10 or 12 gigahertz. And I think they probably make some that go up to 18 gigahertz, where that 50 ohm resistor dummy load with an SMA connector on it, it probably is 50 plus or minus 0.1 ohm across the essentially DC to 18 gigahertz. Very careful construction required to do that. Let me drop. And that Mori microwave calibration kit, I think it sold in the early days for something like $3,000. Today it's probably like $5,000. So you pay enough money, you go to the right company, you'll get a calibration kit. You go to Mini Circuits. Mini Circuits will sell you 50 ohm dummy load devices with an SMA connector on one end. And I bought some of those and measured them on that high quality vector network analyzer that had been calibrated with that high quality Mori microwave system. And some of those mini circuits dummy loads and attenuators, if you buy the right ones, are extremely good. I'm talking about reflection coefficient of around minus 40 dB. Minus 40 dB of S11 at, for instance, 1 gigahertz is equivalent to something like a 1.01 standing wave ratio, 1.02. It's in that neighborhood. And so more than good enough. And those mini circuits, dummy load little things with SMA connector on them, I think they were in the vicinity of a dollar a piece. They weren't extremely expensive. That exact same dummy load 50 ohm resistor bought from Murray Microwave, that one particular component probably sells for $200, maybe more. But so there are ways of around it, so to speak, and to make a, let me drop it.
Got about a minute, Dick.
To make a well-calibrated short circuit, well-calibrated open circuit, is a little bit easier. And by the way, when you buy a short or an open, it is a short or an open with a certain amount of internal length, some number of millimeters of length, from the input face of that connector to the actual internal short circuit or the actual internal open circuit is something that's stamped on the machine, on the calibration device. And so you have to crank that into the calibration procedure when you're doing it with the VNA. Back to you, John. So what do you think we get to look forward to next week out of the mailbag? KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, I hope we'll have a few. We usually do. But they're always interesting. Absolutely. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us on the net, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody and hearing from everybody again next week. Back to you, Dick.
WS1 73, John, Dick. See you next week.
Yeah, we did call you earlier, Paul. I'm assuming you got called away, and it was awful late. I think it wasn't until 11 o'clock we called you. WS2N, K2IW, Grand Paul.
I know, by the time I got back, you were wound up. Good topic, though. I got involved listening to all of this. Back to you, Dick.
So, at around 11 o'clock, we called you, and I guess you were involved in something else at the time because we kept you waiting so long.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. I walked out, and you called in, and that's it. But that's okay. Not a problem. We'll do it next week. We'll be here. Back to you, Dick.
And I've also got a space report, something I want to add, as long as I find the right piece of paper, hopefully next week. Bye-bye, you all. That was TechNet number 1552 of the series that began September of 1982. Excuse me. Bye-bye for now. See you guys next week. K2RW clear. Be kind to each other.
Now I'm going to have to wait till next week to find out where Voyager is. Oh.
It's out there somewhere. It's way out there, John. Way out there.
So one-third copy of it this weekend at the Cradle of Aviation. Back to you, Dick. Maybe repeater will not go off, and you would be able to still give us space reports.
They had a beautiful meeting at the Cradle of Aviation this week. Did you get a chance to go to that one, Paul?
No, I actually just went to the museum and, you know, wandered around. No, I didn't go to a meeting.
They brought the two astronauts that are still alive from Apollo 13 in for a presentation. And I think they had standing room only, 600 tickets, and they sold them out immediately. That was this week at Cradle of Aviation. Bye-bye, you all. Keep your eyes to be clear.
But yeah, that was during the week. No, I actually went yesterday.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul.
73, John.
Thank you very much, guys. John, maybe your repeater is still on. Maybe Paul could give us a space report. What do you think, John?
No, it'll probably go off in a minute or two.
Still on?
I think it cuts out like 7 minutes after, something like that.
Hey, John. So, you can stay in here till it disconnects.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Paul, so what's in space?
Oh, quite a bit. There's a lot up there. By the way, there's two people left from Apollo 13. Schweigert died, oh, he must have been 30 years ago. Some kind of cancer. But the other two guys are around.
morning. The time is 1:39 a.m.
EC2WGB, test 1-2. EC2WGB, clear.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Outside and then change them over.
There you go.